students were to be forcibly bused into the all-white school from distant neighborhoods. South Boston was, and is to this day, one tough neighborhood, dominated by working-class Irish and Italians, who are generally suspicious of outsiders and of authority in general. Back in 74, Southie, as it is called, was entirely inhabited by white people, and most who lived there wanted it to stay that way. So after the judge proclaimed his busing order, blatant hatred took to the streets. There were threats and protests and major fear and loathing, Hunter Thompson's signature phrase. Everybody knew that when the first buses rolled into Southie, anything could happen, and all of it would be bad. Through sheer persistence and hard work, I had become a columnist for the Daily Free Press, BU student newspaper. That position gave me latitude to cover whatever I wanted. So early in the morning on Integration Day, I rode the T, Boston's tramway system, down to South Boston. It didn't take long for a major story to unfold. Here's how I described it in my article. By 7:50 a.m., they were all assembled. Names like Conroy, O'Brien, Leary, LaRosa, and Masso. Plenty of red-haired people with light skin and blue eyes. Young women with acne-infested complexions and thick thighs. Tough-looking boys wearing beach hats and patches of thin facial hair that might one day be beards. Toothless old women were there, too, their sunken faces reflecting a life that refused to allow them the luxury of growing old gracefully. And, of course, the priests were there, trying futilely to calm their flawed flock. At 8:05, the first bus arrived. Small black faces peered dumbfounded from behind bus windows. "F you!" N-word, someone yelled. The obscene chorus swelled. A rock hit the bus. The children were led safely off the vehicle by police, their eyes showing bewilderment and fear, but their confusion had not yet turned to hatred. Out in the street, mothers wheeling babies yelled the vilest obscenities. 6-year-old children stood next to them, echoing the filthy idioms. One kid was especially agitated. "How old are you?" I asked. 13. "You go to school?" "Yeah, but I ain't going till the N-word's cleared out." At that point, the kid's mother turned around. "Don't talk to him, Brian," she said. "Don't talk to anyone you don't know. If they're not from around here, don't have anything to do with them." There was much more to my article, but you get the idea. The fact that I was witnessing history made a deep impression on me, and so did the unfairness of the situation. No American child should have been put in the position of the kids on those buses. Both sides were desperately wrong. I was saddened that my people, the Irish, acted so hatefully toward innocent children. I was also furious that the federal system could not have found a better way to integrate schools. No sane government uses young kids as cannon fodder in an ideological war. From that day on, I knew for certain that journalism would be my profession. Thank God, and I mean that literally, I was given some writing and speaking ability. I was born with it. I have never taken a writing class or a public speaking seminar. It was just there. Now, I'm not a writer on the level of Norman Mailer or a speaker like Barack Obama, who is an amazing orator. But I can wield the pen and speak my mind without fear. These gifts were given to me, I believe, by a higher power. I respect my talent and try to use it for positive change, something I believe I've accomplished over my career. Again, had I been sidetracked by trivial pursuits, had my brain been shrouded in a chemical fog, I would not have seen my vocation so clearly. I would not have been standing there on that warm September morning in South Boston. But I was there, and I will never forget it. I sent my article to journalist Pete Hamill, the legendary New York City-based newspaper columnist. I admired Hamill's work, and my father loved him. Like many students, I was looking for feedback. Unfortunately, Pete Hamill didn't know me at all, and I didn't expect a reply. But a few weeks later, Pete Hamill sent me a very kind letter, full of praise and advice. That push from Pete gave me confidence and courage. And years later, I ran into Hamill and told him that. We became friends. He's the man I most admire in print journalism. Throughout that fall at BU, covering stories became a passion for me. I loved going places and seeing new things. I ran around Boston annoying the hell out of everyone, but bringing back good, crisp copy. In addition to the Free Press, I got stuff published in the Boston Phoenix and the Real Paper. Then I recycled the articles into class assignments. Somehow this worked out great. How could I get a bad grade if somebody had paid me for a piece and it ran on page 2? Full exposure. Without a doubt, my most enjoyable story that semester was a meeting with the infamous stripper Fanny Fox, a.k.a. the Argentine Firecracker. This was huge because Miss Fanny had become an international news sensation. At 2 in the morning on October 7, 1974, Democratic Congressman Wilbur Mills, the powerful Ways and Means Committee leader from Ohio, was stopped by U.S. Park police officers in Washington, D.C., because his chauffeur was driving with the headlights off. Later, authorities determined that Mills was drunk as the proverbial skunk. As cops approached Mills' car that evening, a young woman leaped from the vehicle and ran into the nearby tidal basin, a swampy pool of water. Police chased her down and sent her to St. Elizabeth's Hospital for observation. The woman's name was Annabella Battistella, a 38-year-old striptease dancer from Argentina who performed under the name of Fanny Fox, the Argentine Firecracker. This entire incident, of course, did not look good for the married Mills, and naturally the press went wild, labeling Miss Battistella the tidal basin bombshell. While Mills went into damage control mode, saying that he and the bombshell were just friends, drinking buddies, if you will, the resourceful Fanny went to work. Her agent immediately booked her on a cross-country strip tour, and one of the first stops was Boston. Thank you, God. On a cool November evening, I ventured into Boston's notorious combat zone, a vice-ridden area just north of Boston Common. There, I met Miss Bombshell backstage at the Pilgrim Theater, where she was preparing to take off her clothes for $3,000, a hefty one-night sum in 1974. The woman was very nice to me and my photographer, Con O'Neill, two young Irish guys just trying to get through school. In fact, the Foxette actually changed into her costume right before our eyes, displaying an admirable female form. Am I getting paid for this, I thought? The answer was no, but it was okay. Under my byline, the following words appeared the next day in the Daily Free Press. Miss Fox spoke with a soft Ricky Ricardo accent while talking about the infamous Mills incident. She put it this way. Mr. Mills took four of us out for dinner, dancing, and champagne at a nightclub in Washington. His wife had a hurt foot, so she didn't come. I was sick with the flu and had been taking antibiotics, so after my fifth glass of champagne, I felt sick and dizzy. Normally, I don't drink hard liquor, maybe a little brandy once in a while, but five glasses of champagne would never get me drunk. It was the combination of the champagne and the antibiotics that made me dizzy. I don't remember much else. I panicked when the police stopped us and ran out. I didn't want to see the police. Mr. Mills tried to stop me, but my elbow hit his glasses and they broke, cutting his face. I got out of the car and, being dizzy, fell into the tidal basin. That's all that happened. Made sense to me. Like the Ghostbusters, I was ready to believe her. So Fanny had her story, and she was sticking to it. Who was I to argue? I wasn't with her, and the chairman of the House Ways and Means Committee. Had I been there, perhaps things would have turned out differently, as I would not have been drinking and always drive with the lights on. But again, I was not there. After about 20 minutes, I told Miss Fox I was grateful for her time and turned to leave. She smiled and hit me with this. I don't like to show everything, but I think I'll keep on dancing for 2 years and then go to medical school. Okay. Out in the audience, I grabbed a seat as far away from the clientele as possible. My assignment was to cover Fanny Fox, not get knifed. Here's how I summed up her performance. Fanny whirls out on stage and in no time is down to her underwear. Like a jerk, I am wondering if she's going to show everything. Not only does she show everything, but also the way she moves it around, the everything seems to walk off the stage and come over and sit on your lap. The crowd loves it. After the everything has been shown, Fanny saunters around the stage, bantering with the audience and throwing candy to the patrons. She asks one guy what kind of candy he wants. "Whatever Wilbur Mills didn't eat," the guy screams. Fanny laughs along with the rest of the politically aware audience, finishes her act, and bounces off the stage, everything still intact. I guess you gotta make a living. When my story appeared the next day, I thought it was a home run. But some of the feminists at the Free Press thought otherwise. The women's movement was just getting started, and truthfully, I was not engaged. Nor did I pretend to be. My first priority was finding out if I had talent, if I could cut it in the media world, not trying to figure out Betty Friedan. So, seeking clarity on that front, I sent the fanny piece to the feared movie reviewer, Rex Reed, a guy who loathed many things and was not shy about saying so. Think Simon Cowell. I figured if Reed thought the piece was good, I knew I had something going in journalism. A few days later, Rex Reed's letter arrived on Chicago Tribune New York News stationery. Dear Bill, I think there's a solid future for you in journalism. That interview with Fanny Foxtail is simply great, better than anything that ran in the New York papers. You really do have talent. I hope something good happens for you. Years later, I told Rex Reed that he was directly responsible for my entering the field of mass communications and asked him if I should make that public. He laughed and said he'd pay me not to. What I learned at Boston University firmly set me on the course I continue to this day. Amidst the chaos of Commonwealth Avenue, I found an occupation that I enjoyed, that was noble, at least back then, and that I was certain was my vocational destiny. To this day, I keep these lessons close. Work hard. Keep a clear head. Don't compromise when you know you're right. Give most people the benefit of the doubt. Don't fear authority, and definitely have a good time. Destiny, I believe, played a role in my BU experience, too. Here's my backup for that statement. In February 2008, a Harris poll stated that I, the bold, fresh guy, had been selected the most liked news person in the United States of America. Of course, back in the day, I never dreamed that would ever happen. But it has, and there are many people to blame. You know who you are. Chapter 8, Standing for Something. He is happiest of whom the world says least, good or bad. Thomas Jefferson, August 27, 1786. My friend John Kasich, the former congressman from Ohio, wrote a book about standing for sincere principles that benefit society, and that work is far better than anything I could produce. But in my life, being a stand-up person has obviously become paramount. Thomas Jefferson, of course, did not take his own advice. He tried to do monumental things. And when you make that attempt, people are going to talk, and you are going to get hammered to some degree. Anticipating that kind of acrimony, many people choose to sit it out. Whatever they believe, they keep it mostly to themselves. Play it safe. My parents certainly did that. So if that's true, how did I turn out to be such a primetime bloviator? To understand, we have to once again return, along with the Lone Ranger and Tonto, to those thrilling days of yesteryear, Levittown, in the 1950s. On the night before my 7th birthday, September 9th, 1956, Elvis Presley changed American society. The vehicle was the Ed Sullivan Show, where an astounding 83% of Americans who owned TV sets, about 54 million people, tuned in to see the rock phenom. Presley sang Hound Dog and Love Me Tender. My parents watched. My sister and I were already in bed. We missed some girls in the audience shrieking and Elvis grinning. Sullivan was his usual taciturn self. What Elvis and the other rock pioneers did was alter American culture forever. Rock and roll was not just music, but also an attitude full of rebellion and subversion against conformity and the prevailing wisdom of the 1950s. As Frankie Valli sang in the song Grease, conventionality belongs to yesterday. Under the rock music avalanche, the vanilla entertainment of Perry Como, Patti Page, and other crooners vanished as a dominant force, buried under lyrics and physical gyrations that put the fear of Satan into traditional parents. As the rock money came rolling in, much more provocative entertainment evolved, not only in music, but also in books and movies. Elvis started it all on the mass market level, even though he could never have known that back in 1956. My mother said she liked Love Me Tender. Both parents gave the thumbs down to Hound Dog. Even so, despite harsh criticism about Elvis from religious people and politicians, my parents didn't find Presley disturbing or corruptive. In my house, Elvis was tolerated, although rarely mentioned. But Jerry Lee Lewis and Great Balls of Fire were out, though, even before the killer ran off to marry his 13-year-old cousin. The indifference to Elvis was typical of my parents' reaction to most controversial things. At home, I heard little about the McCarthy hearings or the Cold War or even the Cuban Missile Crisis. My folks knew what was happening in the world but did not feel compelled to comment. Much later, I figured it out. Both of my parents were Depression kids, meaning they were raised in terrible economic times. When Franklin Delano Roosevelt took office in 1933, 25% of working-age Americans were unemployed. My dad was 9 years old. In his Brooklyn neighborhood, hungry people stood in line for hours to get free food. For a young boy, the fear and suffering he saw in the adult world made a lasting impression. My grandfather did have a job as a New York City police officer, but fear was in the air. Children were reared to obey and keep quiet. There was little joy in Mudville. As he grew older, my father's world continued to be one of conformity. His stint as a naval officer during World War II imposed a dramatic discipline on him. Orders were to be obeyed, authority not questioned. My mother was also ultra-cautious and rather complacent. Her childhood circumstances in Teaneck, New Jersey were better than my father's, as both her parents had decent jobs. But constant uncertainty and the paranoia that causes deeply affected both of my parents. They became accepting adults, rarely questioning authority, almost never going against the prevailing wisdom. In middle age, my father realized the downside of buying into complete conformity, but in my house, the code never changed. To get along, you go along. Don't bring attention to yourself, don't rock any boats, save your money, and watch out for bad stuff, because you know what's coming down the pike. And above all else, do not cause trouble. So why didn't I get it? My sister certainly did. Rabble-rousing was nowhere on her resume. But her bold, fresh brother had a decidedly different point of view. When I was a little kid, my independent streak, a kind description, was largely kept under control by constant activity. I was a leisure time demon. A typical summer day might go like this. Get up, put on clothes, eat a bowl of sugar frosted flakes with milk and slices of banana cut on top of it. Stare at picture of Tony the Tiger on cereal box, wondering how tigers eat frosted flakes. Do they have milk, spoons, and bowls in the jungle? Do they have grocery stores there? Do tigers have money to buy cereal? The questions were endless. Grab Davy Crockett coonskin cap, Fanner 56 guns, and holster, and bolt out the door. Forget on purpose to brush teeth. March down the street and pound on Jimmy's door. Can Jimmy come out and play? I ask his mother. Of course. What sane adult would want Jimmy in the house? The kid is a walking disaster and a big-time dirt magnet. Jimmy and I then recruit three other urchins for a trip to the woods a couple of blocks away. There, major shootouts take place and massive amounts of dirt and debris relocate onto my clothing. Home for lunch, with Mom making me change clothes and wash up. Bologna sandwich and Fritos appear. Food, such as it is, bolted down. Baseball hat and glove are procured. Stickball game ensues, with generally three fights over foul balls, high tags, and general disenchantment. Game usually dissolves when Spalding, small pink rubber ball, is hit into someone's bushes and the guy yells at us to stay off his lawn. Mom takes me and a couple of my thug friends to the Carmen Avenue swimming pool, a Levittown perk. Each housing development got a public pool so buyers could think they were living large. At least one fight breaks out in pool, usually over somebody doing a cannonball off the side and landing on another kid's head. Home to dry off and prepare for supper. TV goes on. The Mickey Mouse Club dominates because my sister likes it, and I am beginning to realize that Annette has a lot more going on besides fake ears. Supper, often fish sticks, which are breaded and drowned with ketchup. Sometimes mashed potatoes accompany the delicious fish. Usually the potatoes come out of a box. When I ask my father about it, he says they taste better that way. Even I know that is stretching it. After dinner, play outside for about an hour. The parental order is be home when the streetlights come on. Early evening activity often is ring alivio, where two teams of frenzied children try to maim one another for little apparent reason, much clothing destroyed after supper. Bath time before bedtime. Hate this. Lava brand soap constantly in eyes. And what exactly is the point of cleanliness? Yes, it is next to godliness, but what the heck is that? No one in my circle knows. Lights out about 9, but sometimes, moments before, a late-night snack appears, courtesy of my nice mother. These include Mellomars or Twinkies with milk. Sugar rush before bedtime leads to much tossing and turning before my father bellows, "Settle down before I come in there." In short, the frenetic pace of my childhood prevented me from doing any real damage to others or myself. Those were the days when American kids pretty much did what they wanted in the play area until exhaustion set in. There were plenty of bikes, but no helmets, lots of inventive games, but no play dates, ball games daily, usually without adult supervision, except for the short Little League season. So, for the entire first part of my life, I had largely unsupervised fun, and so did most of the other kids in my neighborhood. That environment will never again be seen in America, thanks to child predators and the internet that has emboldened them. The class factor. Alas, at age 13, I began to change. The year was 1962, and for the first time, I was associating with people who were far different than I was. Up until that first year of high school, every kid I knew was a working-class white person with two parents who lived in a small house that looked just like mine. As I mentioned, I encountered blatant snobbery for the first time at Chaminade High School. Some of my classmates looked down upon me, actually mocked me for my dress and mannerisms. And I wasn't alone. This kind of class-based hazing was rampant at the school. At the same time, I was becoming somewhat aware of the outside world. In August 1962, Marilyn Monroe died, and that was a big deal, although I didn't understand exactly why. Also, there was an ongoing tension between the USA and the Soviet Union. That I understood. The Russians were the bad guys. We Americans were the good guys. Kind of like the Green Bay Packers running over my New York Giants in the championship game that year. I understood. Bad guys. Some of the ordinary guys at Chaminade tried to blend in with the cool segment, but I never did. I paraded my working-class pedigree around and tough if you didn't like it. That was an important decision. To this day, I feel much more comfortable among the folks. The swells hold little appeal for me. But bucking the cool guys at Chaminade was no easy road. They came at me. I went right back at them. I saw other guys brutalized, mostly verbally, by these villains, and they did not fight back. But I did. One quick story on this theme. The Chaminade football team was a perennial powerhouse on Long Island, and I thought I was good enough to make the squad. However, it was essentially a blue-blooded outfit, and the coach, a guy named Joe Thomas, had no room for me, even though I could punt, place kick, and throw the ball as well as anyone he had. After Thomas told me to take a hike, I was teed off but not defeated, so I tried out for the ice hockey team. I wasn't as good at hockey as I was at football, but the team needed a goalie, and I would throw myself in front of speeding pucks all day long. I mean, why not? One problem, goalie stuff. An ice hockey goaltender needs an enormous amount of expensive equipment, from leg pads to special gloves to an all-important protective mask. That cost money, which I did not have. So I improvised. A friend of mine gave me a lacrosse mask. I liberated, Leninist term meaning stole, a baseball chest protector from my summer team, and my mother sewed a knee pad onto the bottom of my first baseman's mitt to create a goalie's catching glove. Perhaps feeling a bit guilty watching the bizarre assemblage, my father then ponied up $25 for some fourth-hand leg pads. To say I looked a bit unusual is to say Boy George is a strange guy. You think? I was Herman Munster on skates, but I did not care. I started in goal, and the Chaminade ice hockey team made the playoffs. It's not how you look, it's how you play, baby. By my senior year, I had made relative peace with the school, even though I had developed an edge in my personality that I have to this day. Simply put, no one was going to push me around, and I would challenge authority if I felt it was oppressive. That was my game plan. Even though I found success in hockey, the football thing still nagged at me. So one day after the football season ended, some of the players were bragging about their athletic prowess. After about 30 seconds, I got fed up with hearing it and issued a clear challenge. My neighborhood friends can kick your butts on the football field. That's what I said. Okay, game on. It was a cold December Saturday in 1966 when members of the Chaminade High School football team showed up in Levittown to play my Sandlot team. But, like a smart college coach, I had been recruiting. My fullback, Gary Kliss, had a cousin in Virginia who was 6'6". Presto. He became a Levittown guy, y'all. Also, I brought in a couple of ringers from the local public school team. We were ready. The Chaminade guys wore their nifty red and yellow jerseys, but we wore gray sweatshirts and jeans. They had cleats, we had sneakers. They were overconfident, we had attitude. Stunningly, my father had volunteered to ref the game because I think he feared a major brawl was going to break out. There was certainly that feeling in the air. He and another Chaminade father stood on the field and kept relative order. Back then, we played tackle football without equipment, not even a cup. It was really rugby, and it was brutal. Of course, I was the quarterback. Early on, I pitched out to Joey Dalton, who promptly fumbled. My father sauntered over and quietly said, "Joey's scared. Get him out of there." Done. By the way, Joey was smart to be petrified. The game was a slaughterhouse, kind of like the movie The Longest Yard. Guys limped off the field or were dragged off after almost every play. By halftime, I saw Chaminade guys looking over to our sideline and staring. There was blood in the dirt. This was genuine class warfare, no question. And my guys knew it. They badly wanted to win this game, and we did. The final score, 24-14. After my father blew the final whistle, one Chaminade guy said, "Hey, let's keep playing." I thought both teams would beat him to a pulp. The game is still talked about back in Levittown more than 40 years after the fact. From that time on, I've always been on the side of the underdog. Anyone watching me on television knows that. I want everyday folks to get a fair shot and the powerful to be held accountable. I believe cops, firefighters, teachers, and the military are practicing noble professions and are the backbone of the nation. It's not that I dislike the white wine crew. I don't. But I'm uncomfortable hanging with them. I don't want to have to explain the songs of Herman's Hermits or the appeal of Charles Bronson. No, I'm happy using my skills and power to stand up for the folks, people with whom I have much in common. At my age, I don't want to learn a new skill set. If I see four forks at the dinner table, I know I'm in the wrong place. Summing up this chapter, I stand solidly for self-reliance, but realize that a fair social and economic system is necessary to complement that. If somebody is getting special privileges, I want to know why. Because of my philosophy, I have taken on some powerful entities in America and have won most of my battles. But like that Saturday football game, it's been a rough fight. There has been blood, as Daniel Day-Lewis well knows. This is not a self-congratulatory analysis. I could have gone another way and there wouldn't have been anything wrong with that. After getting a master's degree from Harvard, I had more than a few opportunities to earn money representing polite society. I turned them down. My mission lay elsewhere. My upbringing demanded it. While I was working as a correspondent for ABC News, a definite blue blood outfit, my friend, the late Peter Jennings, wanted to send me to work in the London Bureau to, quote, round out my rough edges. I told him no thanks, that I wanted to keep the rough edges. He politely told me I was nuts because London back then was the fast-track bureau in the world of network news. Peter Jennings himself had achieved stardom while working out of the London Bureau. But it was not right for me, and I knew it. By the way, without his ever stating it, I believe Peter respected the fact that I was loyal to my roots. When I wrote a piece in Newsweek magazine about working-class Americans who had become wealthy, Jennings asked me to do a report on the article for World News Tonight. That stunned some of the snobby Ivy Leaguers who worked for him. Years later, when Peter saw what I was doing with the O'Reilly Factor, he called me, saying the edges had indeed paid off. "But I could never do what you do," Jennings said. I told him I understood that. Peter was a good guy at heart, but he was a patrician. I really respected him, but I didn't want to be like him. I couldn't say the word shan't, no matter how hard I tried. Hey, I'm a Levittown guy, and that's what I stand for. Okay? Chapter 9, Conservatives versus Liberals. One nation under God, indivisible. The Pledge of Allegiance. Not too many liberals lived in my Levittown neighborhood. This was not a place for progressives. Many of the denizens were former military, and almost all had attended the School of Hard Knocks. That meant money was usually tight and the work hours long. Under that atmosphere, liberal programs like tax-funded entitlements for the unemployed and sympathy for permissive behavior were not eagerly embraced in Levittown. In fact, in the 17 years I lived there, I knew only two people who actually leaned left. Both were mothers of my friends. Sheila M. was a New York Times reading, Adelaide Stevenson-loving lefty. She was also one of the nicest moms in town, a brunette with a perpetual smile. Sheila was loved by us kids because she let us run wild on her property. While most parents shrieked loudly when children roughed up their beloved bushes or shrubs, Sheila could not have cared less. Thus, her lawn became ground zero for violent, mindless games like keep away. Picture two teams of crazed 10-year-old boys, five on each side. A football is thrown into the air, and as it falls, one team tries to grab it and keep possession, while the other team tries to take the ball away. There are no rules, anything goes. There's no scoring, no winners or losers. There is only mayhem, as we ruffians knock one another stupid, trying to either get the ball or keep the ball. In winter, we played this dumb game nearly every day. Of course, Sheila's lawn and surrounding shrubbery were quickly destroyed. I'm talking total annihilation. Nuclear winter stuff. No way my father would have allowed that on our tiny property. In fact, nobody's parents would have it. Only Sheila M. gave us free rein. Much later, when we were talking about the old days, one of Sheila's sons told me she simply believed that kids having fun trumped any sod considerations. Sheila was from the Summerhill School of Child Rearing, whereby the youngster's creative aspirations are all important. Developed by a man named A.S. Neal, Summerhill is an actual school in England where the kids pretty much do whatever they want, short of witch burning. In that permissive atmosphere, the controversial theory goes, children will grow into loving and responsible adults because they have not been traumatized by restrictions. I do not believe there ever have been any nuns at Summerhill. However, there was a downside to Sheila's liberal child-raising point of view, cursing. She didn't do it, but her eldest son, Robert, did it with gusto. While most of us were commanded under threat of punishment not to take the Lord's name in vain or use the F-word, Robert would let profanity fly pretty much any time he felt like it. My mother was appalled. But according to sworn testimony from her three kids, Sheila felt that cursing was just a stage that some children went through. Fine with me, not fine with most of the other parents in the neighborhood. There was some tension over this. The other liberal mom in the neighborhood was Kay, also a very nice woman. Short and thin, with light-colored hair, Kay was the mother of Jeannie and Stu, two kids I met at age three. Unfortunately, Kay was a lapsed Catholic, which meant she did not practice the faith. You'll not be surprised to hear this was not a good thing in Levittown, as most Catholics did not approve of any lapsing. Both St. Bridget's and St. Bernard's churches were packed every Sunday, but Kay, her husband, Jeannie, and Stu were never sighted. One time I asked Stu where his family went to church, and he told me they didn't have to go because they were Unitarian. That sounded good to me, but when I broached the subject with my parents at dinner, the conversation did not go far. Even so, my mother and father were remarkably kind whenever they discussed Kay. My parents were not big on passing judgment unless it involved me. Then judgment was passed with stunning speed. Anyway, like Sheila, Kay was okay with kid conduct that other parents would never have permitted. One day, armed with water pistols, a few of us showed up at Kay's house and proceeded to douse Jeannie in a major way. In response, he got buckets of water and drenched us. We then chased young Gene into his own home, and a massive water fight erupted, causing some visible damage. During this conflict, Kay was across the street at neighbor Betty's house, and upon returning home, found sodden furniture and actual puddles on the floor. Kay just stared. Guilty as sin, we thought all hell was going to break loose. But no, she calmly ordered us out of the house and closed the front door. The next day, I asked Jeannie exactly what his mother did to him. Not much, the kid replied. She just said our conduct was inappropriate. Wow, what a mom. Both Sides Now. Singer Judy Collins had a big hit with a Joni Mitchell song that said she looked at life from both sides. Well, I never got that chance in my childhood. There was only one side, conservative. It was dominant. So, the Russians were bad, as were Castro and all communist agitators. Truth be told, my gang agitated far more than any communist could have. But we did it while loving America. On the 4th of July, everybody flew the flag and went to a picnic. John Wayne and Audie Murphy were huge in the movies, and the blonde, wholesome Doris Day was prettier than any woman on earth. Are we clear about this? That was why the late 1960s were so shocking for many of us in the neighborhood. For the first time in my life, America was being portrayed as bad. That was unheard of in Levittown. But the Vietnam War battered conventional thinking, and within a very short period of time, some kids who were once vocal right-wingers grew their hair long and started thinking Abby Hoffman, co-founder of the Youth International Party, the Yippies, was a cool guy. I, the bold, fresh guy, did not fall into that trap. Perhaps because politics basically bored me, I didn't get emotionally involved with the Chicago 7, Jane Fonda's crew, or any other hysteria. In 1967, I did begin following the Vietnam controversy, but only from a distance. I kept my emotions out of it. That summer, I was still in an all-American 1950s state of mind, lifeguarding for spending money and training hard for the upcoming football season. But even in the barbecue haze of the suburbs, it was hard not to notice the Beatles morphing from clean-cut guys to wild-eyed all-you-need-is-love gurus. Thank God Elvis didn't crack. Unfortunately, as many kids changed their look and style, some adults began badly misbehaving, overreacting to anti-war protests and the rapidly changing culture. I heard a lot of hateful stuff that summer from middle-aged adults who condemned good men like Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. and others who were considered rabble-rousers. That behavior disturbed me as much as seeing some of my friends stoned on whatever they could get. I never got the anti-black thing. New York Giants center fielder Willie Mays was my guy, even after the team moved to San Francisco. Cleveland Browns running back Jim Brown was actually from Long Island. I idolized these men. So when some adults threw the N-word around and mocked blacks, I had a hard time processing it. If all races were cheering blacks on the field, and they were, why would anyone deride that race after the game? The anti-black crew in my neighborhood could never answer that simple question. Levittown, by design, was all white. The real estate agents simply would not sell to blacks. There was no religious restriction, as Jews and Christians lived side by side, but the blacks in the area lived in a neighborhood called Newcastle, a few miles away. We never went there. As racial tensions rose along with the Vietnam chaos, I finally asked my father about it. Both he and my grandfather, a New York City police officer, never bashed blacks in front of me. I never heard that. Once in a while, another group might get slighted, but not black people. I mentioned the following story briefly in Culture Warrior, but I think it's worth repeating in this context. As we sat on the small back patio of our house on a humid evening, my father told me that some folks in our neighborhood had experienced difficulties with blacks in Brooklyn or the Bronx. Many Levittown people were raised in those New York City boroughs and had moved out when the minorities moved in. My father told me that real estate predators, exploiting fear and racism, would buy single-family homes and then illegally rent them to multiple families of minorities, mostly blacks and Puerto Ricans. Almost immediately, entire blocks in New York City were impacted. Once new minority faces appeared, some white families panicked, which was the strategy, and sold their homes to these blockbuster real estate guys at very low prices, whereupon the cycle would continue. Minorities in, whites out. Thus, in a relatively short period of time, whole neighborhoods changed from ethnic white to colored, as they said back then. My father thought the blockbusters were despicable, but some of my Levittown neighbors blamed the minorities themselves for the white flight epidemic. So as the late 60s roared on, both sides held little attraction for me. The conservative side was angry and sometimes bigoted, and the liberal side was equally angry and often hateful toward their own country. With neither choice appealing, I remained on the sidelines, swimming and running, huffing and puffing. Looking back, I'm glad I stayed unaligned. I have never been a follower. I've always thought for myself. Lots of folks across the country lost their minds, and some their lives, back in those turbulent Vietnam years. But I actually kept some perspective. Chalk one up for me. As for the liberal versus conservative deal, the culture war never really erupted in Levittown. Sheila and Kay were the exceptions, as most everybody in the area remained conservative Republican. In fact, the GOP dominated Nassau County right up to the turn of the 21st century. Then the entrenched, arrogant Republican machine blew up, not because of ideology, but because massive corruption was exposed. But to this day, Levittown is working-class hero territory. Few there are exploring a move to San Francisco. As for me, the bold, fresh guy, I'm now branded a conservative by some in the crazed, dishonest, ultra-liberal media, and do you know what? That's fine with me. As stated, I do hold many traditional conservative views and am proud of them. My problem-solving abilities are based on fairness, hard work, and honesty and are not located in some theoretical comfort zone. That's why I win most of my debates on TV and radio. I deal in tough reality, not wishful thinking.
Let me expand on that with a simple example that even the dreamer Jimmy Carter might understand.
The solution to poverty is not sympathy. That makes the sympathizer feel good, but does little to help the guy who needs money. No, the solution to poverty in America is to say, hey, go back to school, learn a skill, and work hard when somebody hires you. And in our society, just about every American has the opportunity to do that. Excuses walk. But no! Sorry, Belushi. Pinheads keep saying that I'm wrong. Poverty is society's fault. Right, John Edwards? He claims there are two Americas. One for rich guys like him and me, who somehow magically acquired money. And one for the poor people, whom the evil government has singled out to be hosed. That line of thinking is pure quackery. A false premise from the jump. No evidence to back it up. As we discussed in the Katrina chapter, individual responsibility is the key to success in life. But as teaching at Pace High School taught me, some individuals will avoid taking that responsibility. For whatever reason, they will hurt themselves and others. Most of the time, I blame them, not America. That, of course, separates me from the left and makes me a mean guy in their eyes. Not that I care, I don't. My vast experience in life makes the following analysis easy, so listen up. Many liberals simply want to feel good about themselves. Showing compassion to the downtrodden accomplishes that. So it's not about the poor, it's about the liberal thinker. He or she wants to feel noble. The math here is pretty clear. If you blame someone for his or her own difficult circumstances, that's a harsh assessment, not a feel-good proposition. But if you blame a country or a system and give the individual a free pass, then you are understanding and kind. But think about it. What good does that really do? Of course, some poor people deserve pity, but far more would benefit from instruction and discipline. Look at the 1996 Welfare Reform Act signed by Bill Clinton. By the way, the official title of the law is the, quote, Personal Responsibility and Work Opportunity Reconciliation Act. Wow. Many liberals screamed about its supposed unfairness, but studies show it helped far more Americans than it hurt. Forcing people to work led to millions of Americans entering the capitalistic system, where they could actually accomplish something. Of course, that benefited both the individual and society. Did John Edwards miss that? No, Edwards didn't miss it. He just wanted to play to the far-left crowd in his dismal run for the presidency. What a charlatan. And one more thing. If you see Edwards or any of his ideological soulmates, tell him this. In 1960, just about 5% of American babies were born out of wedlock. Now, 35% are. And for African Americans, the number is an astounding 70%. That's what drives poverty, single mother homes. Individual Americans having children they cannot afford to raise is the primary cause of poverty in the United States. That's a fact. And here's another fact. John Edwards and his ilk are pinheads, no doubt. A Malox moment. Because I choose my friends based upon their characters, not their ideology, I have a number of liberal pals with whom I can honestly discuss issues like what drives poverty. Recently, I was in Los Angeles having dinner with a friend of mine who is big on universal health care. She's really jazzed about the government providing medical care to all who need it. So the bold, fresh guy, in between bites of calamari, surgically took her opinion apart. Great friend, right? First, I asked her if Americans had a constitutional right to health care. Being of the liberal persuasion, of course, she said yes. Okay. Then I asked, if good health is indeed a protected right, shouldn't nutritious food be provided as well? After all, one cannot have good health without good food. Being a smart lady, she saw the chess move and said she'd have to think about that. But the bold, fresh guy was moving in. Nothing could stop me, not even the Dover sole the waiter placed in front of me.
Why do you have to think about it? I asked. You can't separate nutrition from health. Can't be done. So by your way of thinking, the government has an obligation to provide good food to ensure good health for those who need it, right? Maybe, she answered, chewing her sushi a bit more aggressively. Okay, I said. And how about decent housing? If you live in substandard housing, it will definitely affect your health, no question, right? At this point, my friend smiled because she's a great person with no rancor and freely chooses to undergo grillings like this from her misguided friend, me. Sure, good food, good housing, it's all tied in, she said. And the government should provide those things to the poor? Yes. Well, you're a socialist. She smiled wider. I guess I am, she said. That means I'll have to pick up the check, I replied. Want dessert? You can see why dinner with me is not exactly on the menu for many people. But I'm right when I say the left wants a big daddy government to provide. The problem is that's impossible in America. If you don't believe me, recall your personal bureaucratic nightmare when trying to get a passport or a driver's license. And you want the government telling you which doctor to go to? Come on. Independent thinkers like me realize that government safety nets must be provided for folks who cannot, for whatever reason, negotiate life on their own. That is realistic compassion. But in a nation of 320 million people, the government simply cannot provide for your needs. It is truly impossible. Instead, creative programs like tax-free medical savings accounts and deregulation of the healthcare insurance industry, with strict rules and oversight by the authorities, are the best solutions to the chaotic healthcare problem. But the left is generally not on board with that. Not to belabor left-wing blind spots, but I have to return to my pal John Edwards one last time before I move on to some conservative failings. On January 3, 2008, Edwards first claimed that 200,000 U.S. veterans were homeless and abandoned, sleeping under bridges because the economy was stacked against them. How could the USA allow that to happen? Edwards wailed. What is wrong with our country? Now, this sounded a bit fishy to me, so I asked the Fox News Brain Room to check it out. That's the research arm of the Fox News Channel, and those guys are good. Quickly, the information came back. There were no accurate accounts of homeless vets, just estimates by some veteran organizations that are dependent on donations to exist. Thus, they had a vested interest in putting out high homeless vet numbers. There was also no reliable economic data on homeless vets. But Joseph Califano, who heads a substance abuse think tank at Columbia University, estimated that 90% of homeless vets are either addicted or mentally ill. And the stats just kept on coming. The Brain Room found out that the Department of Veterans Affairs provides 150,000 beds each evening of the year for vets who need shelter. Agency workers will even pick up the vets and take them to the facilities. Finally, the U.S. government is now spending a record amount of money on health programs for vets in all areas. After I made all of those facts known, Edwards went on David Letterman's program and in the ensuing discussion, agreed with Dave that I was lying about the vets. The candidate insisted yet again that the economy was forcing vets to live on the streets, and Dave, being the committed liberal that he is, enthusiastically agreed. Well, the whole controversy soon became moot for Edwards. A few days after his Letterman appearance, he dropped out of the presidential sweepstakes and returned to his $6 million, approximately 30,000 square foot home on 102 North Carolina acres. Two Americas, indeed. So you tell me, is it not difficult to respect the false premise that left-wing loons like Edwards put out there? Or am I wrong? By the way, for all the yammering on the left about increased government spending on social programs for the poor, studies show that conservative religious people give far more to charity per capita than secular progressives. The truth hurts, right, progressive people? Might makes right. Staunch conservatives often are resistant to change by definition. In 1960s Levittown, skepticism greeted most new trends until, of course, they reached critical mass. I say we were generally at least a year behind what was happening socially in California, and some things have never caught on, like gelato. Now, sometimes failing to change for the sake of change is good. Caution is not a bad thing. But sometimes conservatives, like their left-wing counterparts, can be terribly wrong. Here's a good example. In 1986, President Ronald Reagan, by far the most admired conservative in the country right now, allowed about 3 million illegal aliens amnesty and then did little to stop millions of other foreign nationals from entering the United States illegally in the wake of his beneficent citizenship action. Subsequently, Presidents Bush, Clinton, and Bush the Younger all followed Reagan's lead and avoided confronting the illegal alien issue. Of course, disaster ensued. Estimates are there could be as many as 15 million people living in the USA illegally, causing financial and social chaos in many parts of the country. In addition, five of the 1911 killers were in the country illegally, and despite that, it is still relatively easy to sneak into America for whatever purpose. Now, you would think conservative leaders would have aggressively tried to control the illegal immigration situation, but they obviously did not. Big business wanted cheap labor, and so the right did the wrong thing. They acquiesced to business and failed to act. Likewise on oil. My father worked for Chevron, the parent corporation of Caltech, and told me in the 1960s that the Arabs had the USA over a barrel. Anyone with a brain knew that cheap foreign oil was a powder keg. That's one of the reasons why Japan started World War II, to secure oil supplies in Southeast Asia. But conservative presidents from Eisenhower to Bush the Younger did little to develop alternative fuel or encourage conservation and better fuel standards for American automobiles. Now all of us are paying big time for that sellout. And while we're on the subject, one of the reasons that Al Gore has never agreed to be interviewed by me is that he knows I would ask him why he didn't push alternative fuel and conservation in the 8 years he was vice president. The record shows the Clinton administration was abysmal in that area. What say you, Mr. Gore? Maybe Al had an epiphany after he left office. His global warming quest might have changed his perspective. Fine. But Clinton Gore had plenty of time to pound the alternative fuel drum and did not. And speaking of global warming, some conservatives are nitwits on this subject, are they not? My take again is simple. Only the deity knows if the current warming trend on Earth is man-made or part of a long-term natural cycle. To debate the cause of global warming is a complete waste of time. Again, no one knows why. We just know the Earth's temperature is going up. Are you hearing me on this? But what all sane people should know is that clean air and water are good things, right? Eating fish contaminated with mercury is not my idea of fine dining. So shouldn't we all be demanding that governments clean up their countries and stop the madness? Why is pollution control an ideological issue? Okay, let's transition into more ideological idiocy. Crazed ideologues on the right who laugh off environmental concerns are just as stupid as crazed ideologues on the left who have somehow determined that human life in the womb is expendable. Just as with global warming, no one knows exactly when life begins. Only the deity knows. You can believe anything you want, but you don't know. We do know one thing, however. Scientists have proven that upon conception, human DNA is present. Get it? The fetus already has the codes in place from its biological mother and father. So the mass of non-human cells argument goes right out the window if you're an honest person. In my opinion, the compassionate liberal cadre that supports abortion on demand for any reason at any time is guilty of gross human rights violations. Worshipping at the altar of reproductive rights is wrong. Abortion should be rare, regulated, and discouraged. Human dignity demands it. So you can see that the bold, fresh guy has some problems with both sides of the ideological spectrum. But unlike Judy Collins, who sang about not knowing life at all, I'm more confident in my views. Independent thought based upon greater good, realism, and yes, compassion, drives my agenda and dictates my analysis. Two more things. Some conservatives are moralists, that is, they frame their opinions with the concept of sin. That's a loser all day long, despite the fact that Sister Lorana would have pummeled me for saying that. Let's go back to the out-of-wedlock birth rate. I've heard right-wing commentators condemn this situation on moral grounds, saying that people in this situation are guilty of sinful behavior. But why bother with that line of thinking when secular progressives, who are loath to make moral judgments, are not likely to listen? Instead, why not continually point to poverty? Virtually every study ever done on the poor in America says that homes run by single mothers have a much higher chance of being destitute than homes with a mom and a dad. This is undeniable and crushes all liberal arguments against traditional family units. When the living together and babies out of wedlock trend began to challenge traditional marriage in the late 60s, few liberals foresaw the decline of the family that subsequently has led to enormous social problems. And right there is the big problem with committed liberal thought. The quest for individual gratification, for self-expression above responsibility to others, often has huge unintended consequences. If it makes you feel good, sounded great, coming from Janis Joplin, remember that? She died at age 27 from a drug overdose. I bet it would feel a whole lot better to be alive today. Chapter 10, Heroes and Zeros. No man is justified in doing evil on the ground of expediency. Theodore Roosevelt. Closing in on age 11 in the summer of 1960, I became a more creative hellraiser. Summerhill would be proud. Using my organizational skills, my gang gathered for nighttime raids that included kicking over full garbage cans and swimming in people's pools under the cover of darkness. We did it purely for fun, and it was harmless. Annoying, but harmless. The big pop hit that summer was Brian Hyland's Itsy Bitsy Teeny Weeny Yellow Polka Dot Bikini, which blared daily from the loudspeakers at the Carmen Avenue swimming pool. WABC Radio, the big New York rock station, spun the bikini song every hour on the hour, driving more than a few parents underwater. But I liked the song very much, especially the finale. From the locker to the blanket, from the blanket to the shore, from the shore to the water, guess there isn't any more. Is that poetry or what? In the cinema, there was an Alfred Hitchcock movie called Psycho that my parents would not let me see. This was disturbing. It couldn't be any worse than Not of This Earth, could it? Besides, the ad said that the theater had a nurse standing by in case anybody passed out from fright. I'm not making that up. But my folks would not give in. They might already have one junior psycho on their hands. They didn't feel Hitchcock needed to further the situation. Many days that summer, we played stickball on the hot pavement of Levittown's Patience Lane because a ton of kids lived on that poorly named street. You see, some adults residing on Patience Lane had absolutely no patience whatsoever, and in early July, an interesting little skirmish broke out. At issue was the little ball itself. Often, it was being hit onto lawns. That required fielders to leave the public street and chase the ball onto private property. Many adults on Patience Lane ignored the trespass, but some did not. The worst offender was Mr. D, a tall, balding guy with a dour disposition. If you can believe it, that guy actually confiscated the ball when it rolled onto his lawn. Let me repeat that. The guy took the ball. Of course, that could not stand. As mentioned earlier, the balls, called Spalding's, were small and bouncy, and cost about 10 cents each. By taking the ball, Mr. D was costing us money, but that wasn't the big issue. No, the major point of contention concerned a unilateral hostile action against us kids. It was the principal involved. Even though we were not quite clear why, my gang was big on principal. So Mr. D had to pay. Now, you might be asking why we didn't go to our parents and have them negotiate with Mr. D for the return of the ball. A perfectly logical but naive question. Back then, parents stuck together. Rarely, if ever, would a parent side with a kid against an adult. It was some kind of demented anti-kid code. Plus, technically, Mr. D was correct. My stickball teammates and I had no legal right to trample his lawn. So we deemed parental intervention to be a loser and never even considered it. Instead, vigilante justice, widely admired by my gang, was put into motion. Kids today, of course, could read my recent book about the rights of children, Kids Are Americans Too, and come up with a smarter approach. But that summer, we were on our own. Because the Mr. D revenge operation was a nighttime play, let me set the tactical scene. My bedroom was the only one upstairs in the O'Reilly house. My sister and parents slept on the ground floor. Often in the summer, it was ungodly hot upstairs. Air conditioning? Are you kidding me? Only rich people could afford that. To stop my whining, my father did eventually buy me a small fan, but when I pointed out that it simply blew the humid air into my face that much quicker, he replied in his usual pithy way, "So, don't use it." Okay. Back then, most everybody in Levittown left all the doors and windows open in the summertime, hoping that an occasional breeze would waft in through the screens. That made it easy for me to silently walk down the stairs and exit undetected through the back door of my house at any time during the night. Piece of cake. This tactical advantage was key to Operation Mr. D, and here's how it went down. I had an old alarm clock in my room that rang so loudly, dogs would file charges. The hellish thing was so annoying, I never used it. Not only was it loud, but the ringing also went on forever. This was a perfect nocturnal weapon. I believe it was a Thursday night, but I could be wrong about that. I also believe four of us met up at Sheila's house at around 1 in the morning, but that too might be a misty, watercolored memory, as Barbara Streisand once sang. But no matter, it was late on a weekday night when little Dave, the most agile climber, scooted up the tree outside Mr. D's upstairs bedroom and taped the alarm clock to a branch just a few feet away from his open window. The alarm was set to go off 15 minutes after Dave began his climb. Mission accomplished, Dave scampered down and we all hid in the bushes outside of Sheila's house, which was almost directly across the street from Mr. D's place.